From Michigan Radio, this is a State of Opportunity special, Breaking Ground, Being Young and Transgender in Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, just what does it mean to be transgender?
You know, your sexual orientation is who you want to go to bed with. Your gender identity is who you want to go to bed as.
Voices from the trans community.
Bathrooms are supposed to be sort of private. Why does it matter what genitalia the person in the next stall over has?
Working to build understanding of trans people and trans issues.
And that there's nothing wrong with being gay or trans. It's okay to be different. Being different is not necessarily to be inferior or to be broken or wrong.
Providing equality for this community and other marginalized communities does not sacrifice the safety, you know, and equality and quality of life for the rest of the country. It does not.
Welcome to this State of Opportunity special. I'm Cynthia Canty. Our nation, and certainly our state, is engaged in an intense emotional debate about transgender people and their rights. Much of the debate and much of the heat has centered on bathrooms and whether transgender people should use the bathrooms or locker rooms of the gender they identify with.
Are we excluding other kids' rights and their privacy rights at the expense of others?
They actually promote behaviors that are not supportive of safety, not supportive of good health, not supportive of a safe environment, secure environment, not just for those students that choose that, but also for all the other students that are in that environment.
We've seen controversial laws and ordinances passed in North Carolina, in Houston, and elsewhere. Here in Michigan, nearly 11,000 people have commented on the State Board of Education's draft of voluntary guidelines for schools to meet the needs of their transgender students. The next topic listed for public comment is a code of student conduct question. It has exactly 25 comments. Clearly, trans people and trans issues ignite strong opinions, strong emotions. But those views may not be built on knowledge or an understanding about the transgender experience. And there is so much more to this than which bathroom someone can use. So let's spend this hour seeking knowledge and exploring what it means to be young and transgender in Michigan. Throughout this hour, we welcome your questions on Michigan Radio's Facebook page or on Twitter at State of Op, and that's with two P's. We'll have reporters and producers standing by for you. Let's start with the most basic questions. What does gender mean, and what's the difference between gender and sex?
Gender and sex. Oh, wow, that's a deep question. Gender is the way to you decide to live your life. Sex is very different.
I feel like sex is what you were born with biologically, and gender is how you identify.
Okay, then. So what does it mean to be transgender?
Isn't that when somebody changes from a male to a female or a female to a male? They're born in the wrong body.
I guess to me that means somebody who biologically might have been born one way and identifies as a different way. That's the way I usually think of it, mostly informed by TV shows that I've seen, like Transparent.
Cale Keegan is with us now from Grand Valley State University. He's an assistant professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies and liberal studies. As a teacher and trans man, Cale has a lot of experience explaining transgender people and trans issues. Professor Keegan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I am so glad that we could turn to you for what one might call Transgender 101. In one or two sentences, how do you define transgender?
I like to think of it kind of as what trans people fall outside of our sort of normative definitions for gender and sex. We have a gender and sex system with really only two options, male, female, man, woman. And so if you think about how humans are naturally very diverse, there are lots of people who have experiences that fall outside of that organization, you know, the two very sort of static categories. Trans people are really just people who, for some reason or another, disagree with their assignment in that system. You know, we're all born before we have any control over what happens to us. We're assigned a category, a gender category, and that category is assumed to stick with us for the rest of our lives. We're assumed to just kind of accept it. And trans people, broadly defined, are people who that assignment doesn't really work for different reasons. I think just thinking about how the system itself doesn't really match 100% of all the people, you know, that's mm-hmm. That's an easy way to think about it.
And how is being transgender different from being a cross-dresser, from drag, or from being gay or lesbian?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think because we tend to lump LGBTQ people all into kind of one mental category, people who kind of don't fit. We don't often think about some of the more nuanced differences between these groups. So crossdressers, drag performers, and lesbian and gay people, none of those categories are actually about gender identification. Crossdressers tend to, and there tend to be straight men who enjoy dressing in clothing of the opposite gender, feminine clothing. But these people are not interested in becoming women or living their lives as women. They do it mostly for pleasure in social settings. And there's a long history of drag performance in gay culture, but these people are not seeking to live as that gender in their daily lives.
And Kale, there's the word cisgender that I think can be puzzling to people. Just what is that and how does it relate to transgender?
Sure. Just like we developed the word straight to kind of name people who are not gay, cisgender is a word that simply names people who are not trans. It's a way of indicating that, you know, being non-transgender isn't necessarily natural, like the only way to be. There are many different ways to be. And so, you know, cisgender is just a way of naming that normative experience as one of many possible types of experience, just like straight people have a different experience than gay people.
All right. And then gender identity, sexual orientation, not the same, right? Although I think a lot of people get confused by that and they conflate the two.
Yeah, I think for so long we've had a conversation that really focused on lesbian and gay identities as the different category. You know, gay and lesbian people are different from straight people. The way that they're different is they're attracted to the, you know, same gender rather than the what we would call the opposite gender. And trans people's experiences are just different. Their difference is constructed by the fact that they don't identify with the gender assigned to them. So this is different from who we're attracted to. An easy way to think about that is sexual orientation is who you want to go to bed with, and gender identity is who you go to bed as. That's kind of like a sort of pat way of explaining it. But gender identity, who we psychologically experience ourselves to be, is not equivalent to who we are attracted to externally.
Kale, we hear that term gender nonconforming. Can someone be gender nonconforming whether or not they actually identify as transgender?
Yes, actually. There are lots of different ways to present gender and live gender. There are plenty of people who are, you know, men with long hair in our culture would be considered in some cases gender nonconforming because the standard gender role for man in gender presentation is to have short cropped hair, to not wear nail polish, right? These things that they're not necessarily natural expressions of one gender or another. They're cultural. So, in fact, some of the issues we're seeing around bathrooms right now with these new laws passing is that it's not necessarily trans people who are being ejected from bathrooms. It's gender nonconforming cisgender people who simply don't look the right way, right? They are not gender conforming based on those gender binaries that we culturally have around.
Okay, what's the connotation of that prefix trans? Is it as in transcend, like moving beyond the constructs of gender?
Well, if you can talk to lots of people have opinions about this, right? Generally speaking, I think the definition trans, if you look at the root of the word, it means to move. So that could be above, right? Move above the gender binary. There are people who don't really identify with either being a man or woman. It can also mean across, meaning to cross that binary divide between what we consider male and what we consider female. So some kind of motion away from that initial gender assignment. But in what direction? That's kind of open.
And do we have any idea how many people are trans?
We really don't. People have been trying to estimate this for a long time. But because there was so much social stigma around coming out as trans, those numbers, I think we have to assume, are sort of artificially depressed. So the most recent estimate is around 700,000 Americans out as transgender. But I think we can assume that as the culture shifts and people feel more comfortable living and being out, that number will probably rise.
I'm speaking with Kale Keegan, who's assistant professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies and liberal studies at Grand Valley State University. Why do you think it is that trans issues and trans people have come to the national front burner now?
I think it has everything to do with gay marriage becoming legal federally and nationally. That was really the hot button issue for so long in our culture. For 25 years, we debated that. And it had the effect of taking up all the oxygen. So when people were upset about, you know, the perception that gender and sex are changing in our culture, which they always have, they've always been fluid and changing. People got really fixated on gay marriage as the kind of problem, right? That was the big thing. Now that that has passed and kind of It's off the table as a political football. What we have now is trans people coming into that vacuum and starting to be the population that people are really, really concerned about controlling and policing.
Why do you think that is, this idea of, yeah, we need to police and control? Why is this provoke such a deep visceral reaction? I mean, why so much stigma?
I think it has a lot to do with the images of trans people that people were raised with in our culture. A lot of people who are adults now were children in the 80s. That's at least my experience. and I grew up with films like, you know, Dress to Kill, Sleepaway Camp, Silence of the Lambs, these movies that portrayed trans people as serial killers, as molesters, as violent, as psychotic. And it's in many ways the way that gay men and lesbians were represented in the 1950s. And so we are dealing with a culture that has been indoctrinated into believing that trans people are dangerous. And it's really going to take a while before we can work through those stereotypes and realize that they don't really match reality. Trans people are just people trying to live our lives, trying to contribute to society. And we are the ones actually who are being exposed to danger. If you look at the rates of abuse and murder of trans people.
Do you believe you will see a day when being trans is not a cause for someone to be stigmatized or marginalized or held at arm's length?
I want to believe that such a time is possible. It's certainly what I'm working for in my own profession, is to raise awareness and help educate people about these topics. We know that there are other cultures historically where stigmatization of trans people was not built into the culture. The Native North American populations that existed before the colonization of the U.S. by Europeans actually had tertiary and quaternary gender systems where there were more genders than just two. So we know these kinds of cultures are possible and that they work. The question is, can we get there? How long will it take?
Cale Keegan is a teacher of gender studies and a trans man. He is assistant professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies and liberal studies at Grand Valley State University. Cale, it was great talking with you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Breaking Ground, Being Young and Transgender in Michigan, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. When the first openly transgender kid comes out at a school, people have a lot of questions. Teachers and administrators might feel like they've been thrown into the deep end. The State Board of Education is proposing voluntary guidelines to help schools in this situation. But as we've noted, those guidelines have sparked a fierce backlash. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells visited one school in West Michigan that found out making a plan can make all the difference.
Kylie Clifton is 12 years old. She has these long, thick waves of blonde hair. And the day that she went with her mom to the hair salon and got those hair extensions, that was a big day because it not only made Kylie feel like she looked beautiful, it also meant that the next day she would definitely be going to school as Kylie and not as Kyle, the boy that she had outwardly been.
I couldn't chicken out. Like, I'm not very good with decisions, so I couldn't just take them out that morning and just put it off for another day as if I thought I wasn't ready.
But getting here, getting ready, that took a lot. Because just a few months before, when Kylie was still living as Kyle, things had gotten to a pretty dark place. Kyle's family knew that sometimes his anxiety was overwhelming, but they didn't really know why. Because Kyle didn't tell them about the thoughts that he was having. That his whole life, every time he watched a movie, he pictured himself in the girl's role, in the Marilyn Monroe or the Jennifer Lawrence. And then when he tried to picture his future growing up and becoming a man, it just seemed very fuzzy, like an impossible thing. But in Kyle's 11-year-old brain, becoming the girl that he wanted to be, that seemed like something that was equally impossible.
Maybe I would just kind of disassociate myself from everyone and just kind of move away and not be heard from. I don't know. Crazy thoughts like that.
So finally, one night, Kyle works up the courage to talk to his mom about this. So it's about 10 o'clock at night, and he sends his mom a text.
It was a Wikipedia transgender link, is literally the only thing that she sent. I was home in the house. So I brought my phone upstairs and I showed it to her and I said, so I think we have some things to talk about.
This is Kylie's mom. This is Ginger Clifton. And it turns out that this was the easy part because the family, they got it. For Kylie's parents, this actually made a lot of sense. But figuring out the whole school thing, that was what Ginger was worried about. They had just moved. They were sending the kids to a brand new school district, Portage Public Schools, just south of Kalamazoo. And she sets up her first ever meeting with the principal and the school counselor.
And their eyes got really big, but they were very willing to work with us, even though they really didn't know quite exactly how to do it.
It was an interesting conversation. It was a difficult conversation because no one had any experience with it.
This is Travis Thompson. He is the principal at Portage Northern Middle School. And what the school did next is really important. It's also something that a lot of other schools are starting to do more and more. They brought in a professional.
You know, whenever you're pushing for change in an area of something that people don't understand, sometimes the worst comes out in people when they're afraid.
This is Jay Maddock, and technically his job title is Executive Director of the Kalamazoo Gay and Lesbian Resource Center. But really, his job is managing fear. And at his training sessions for teachers and staff, there's one fear that he hears over and over and over again.
Well, what if students start to pretend?
As in, what if a guy pretends to be a transgender girl in order to get into the women's restroom and hurt somebody? So Maddock tells them, okay, here is what you're going to do. When a transgender student comes out, sit down with them, get to know them, make a transition plan. Ask them when they want to start using different pronouns, maybe a different name. And yes, ask them what bathroom they want to use. And make it school policy that without this kind of transition plan, kids can't just switch restrooms whenever.
Let's imagine that an adolescent pulls a prank and goes into, you know, a restroom that doesn't match with their gender identity. We're not asking for you to uphold that. So when a student violates your school rules, they're still violating the rules.
Now, the genius of this, Maddock says, is that even doing something this simple, it gives schools what they really want right now, clarity, something that tells them what to do so that if parents get angry, they can point to it and say, look, we have thought this through and it puts us on the right side of the law. Specifically, Title IX, that is the federal law that makes gender discrimination illegal at schools. And the U.S. Department of Education is cracking down on it, telling schools this means you have to let transgender kids use the bathrooms that fit their gender identity. At Kylie School, this Title IX stuff really stuck with Principal Thompson.
That helped guide some of our decision making.
So Thompson brought Jay Maddock in. They did staff trainings for all of the teachers. They covered all the basics. What is transgender? Why do transgender kids face more bullying, have a higher risk for suicide? What kind of logistics are involved in helping a kid transition at school? So after all of this, I asked Principal Thompson, what happened? What happened when Kyle transitioned to Kylie and eventually started using the girls' bathroom? Was there an uproar? Were parents upset?
To be perfectly honest, there wasn't a reaction. You know, it was a non-issue for our students and our staff. It just wasn't an issue.
What about for Kylie?
I was nervous at first, as there's usually always a lot of people in the girls' bathroom, but it didn't matter. No one acted like they cared.
As more and more transgender students come out, more schools are going to have to figure out their responses. The State Board of Education's optional guidelines for schools were supposed to help them do that, but the backlash from Republican lawmakers, from worried, upset parents, it's been fierce. And it's been the kind of backlash that makes you wonder if it's going to be harder for transgender kids to come out, which is kind of why Kylie wanted to talk about this so publicly. She says she wants other kids to know that sometimes when you come out, it's just okay.
I think it could just potentially help someone else. And I don't really have a problem with it. Some people don't really like talking about it, but I mean, it's the truth.
Right now, the State Board of Education is still taking public comments online and in person about those LGBT school guidelines right up through May 11th. More than 10,000 people have already weighed in on these guidelines online. First Date of Opportunity, I'm Kate Wells.
Let's talk more about coming to terms with the fact that you are not who you appear to be to the rest of the world, and what it's like when you're able to present the way you truly feel. Eliza Downey came out as transgender and began presenting as a woman early in high school. She's now an 11th grader, and she is with us now. Eliza, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining us. How old were you, Eliza, when you first realized, you know what, this isn't working for me? What were those feelings?
I was about 15, and the feeling was that I was just – I didn't really know exactly what it was. I knew that as I was leaving 8th grade and going through that summer – going from middle school to high school, I was feeling the worst, and that was when my depression was worst. And from that point, I started to sort of do more feminine things. The main thing that I got into was I started watching. I don't know if I can say this on the radio, but My Little Pony.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I started getting into that, and like it just sort of kind of felt good, I guess, to embrace a little bit of something that's stereotypically feminine.
And did,
at least for me,
did it go back even before middle school? Because I know you were homeschooled for a number of years, and I just wondered, was that starting to kind of bubble up inside even when you were at home?
It didn't really affect me that much when I was younger and when I was being homeschooled, because I was never forced, I've never had the stereotypical like male gender roles forced onto me. It only started to appear when I went into public school and people were like, oh, yes, you are a boy. You must do boy thing.
And boy thing didn't feel right.
No, not at all.
And in middle school, oof, that's a tough time anyway. And at what point then you said, all right, going into high school, is that a point where you said, you know what, this isn't working for me and now I have to?
Well, it didn't really – not much changed about how I presented or how people mm-hmm. knew me until after my 9th grade year. But in that time, I was still kind of like shy and – not very open, but as I went through that year, a new person came to my old homeschooling group, and I still kept in contact with them pretty well. And they started talking about being trans, and I was like, oh, what? That's a thing that exists? Because up until then, I didn't really hear about it until that point. And when I did, it was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And as I progressed through that year, I started to feel more and more like that's probably what I was. I was probably somewhere on that spectrum. And after that year, I had not done too particularly well in school and had to go to summer school. So I started being like, I want to use she, her, hers pronouns. And it like went over pretty well in summer school, I started to actually go by that in my friend group, and then it went from my friend group to my parents, and then it's slowly creeping its way up through the rest of the family now.
You say it went pretty well in summer group, so people were like, how were they? Like, okay.
I was like, hey, I'm a girl too, and then some of the people there were like, oh, okay, sweet.
No problem.
Like that's just, they're just completely chill about it, and I'm like, oh, this feels good.
And then time to take it home and tell them at home. And how did that go?
Well, with my dad, I just kind of was straightforward with him because I've always kind of been a little bit more like confidential and might like have like tell him more of like secretive things because I know that he doesn't really care what I do other than like as long as I'm safe.
So it felt safe to tell him.
Yeah, it felt safe to tell him. It was a little bit more. I felt kind of sketch about telling my mom because I know that my stepdad, he's a nice guy, but he can be a little bit like, if something's like super emotional, he can like get a little bit intense. And I didn't want to upset him or get him worried or anything like that. So it sort of happened accidentally when one of my friend's parents referred to me as Eliza and used she, her, hers. And my mom was like, so, hey. Eliza.
So this is going on. That's how your mom kind of found out?
Mm-hmm. And then she told my stepdad, and I think she told him when I wasn't, like, around or anything, and he was, like, totally, it was all fine. I think that the only reason why I didn't tell him was mostly because of anxiety, and I was worried that I'd upset him in some way, and I didn't want to.
So your mom and dad were both the supportive and safe people to take this and go, okay, and she ran interference mm-hmm. with your stepdad.
Yeah.
Then it's time to go back to school.
Yeah. I sort of came out to a couple of my school friends over that we went to choir camp and all of my choir friends knew. And as they started to know, they also started to spread the word. So by the time we actually got back into school, a good half of my friend group already knew. So then it kept coming up in conversation. So it just sort of happened more naturally than anything else.
And there wasn't any big ta-da moment then. It was kind of organic. Sounds like it was just kind of a process that just happened.
I think that process was more bred out of insecurity than confidence or anything like that.
What do you mean?
I didn't say anything outright to everybody like, no, I am Eliza, you, she, her pronouns. Mm-hmm. It just sort of happened through my other friends.
And as your friends started saying, okay, Eliza, and using she and her, how did that change how you treated yourself?
I started to become a lot more confident in myself and not have as many self-disliking problems. Like I didn't dislike myself that much, like as I did, because I started to sort of have a little bit of like a self-loathing. But it sort of started to help. Like I realizing that my personality is a good and is not wrong.
That has to be like this huge load off of your heart and your soul to go, hey, I'm okay. When you can feel like who you really are.
Yeah. It is very comforting to know that the people that you're around all of your time are like totally there for you, and then knowing that you can be exactly who you are around them.
Now, what's school like for you now?
It's pretty good. The main problem that I have at school is there's only a couple of things. Things like bathroom and locker room rules are kind of an issue because I feel like even before coming out, I just felt really, really gross being around anyone in the locker rooms. But also I can't go into the girls' locker rooms because, I have male genitalia. It will instantly cause inappropriate things to happen, which I find honestly a bit absurd because one issue that a lot of people have pointed out about having trans people go into bathrooms is that, you know, sexual things can happen. But the one thing that's pretty dumb about that is that there are people who are not, you know, just 100% the vagina and penis. I mean, like, there are people who are gay and lesbian and bi and pansexual and all of those other things that I can't even begin to all list. But it's just, if you really wanted to stop all of that stuff from happening, there should just be an individual stall for every student, like an individual room with a door that locks.
You said you always felt kind of icky in the guy's bathroom. But was there ever a point where you were worried for your own safety?
No, I never have really had a point to worry about my own safety. I'm blessed to live in Ann Arbor, which is like a little bubble of like queer security in the rest of Michigan. Other places in Michigan are like safe, like basically like anywhere around Ann Arbor, basically every city that touches us is safe. But it's kind of like the little bubble beyond that that's where it becomes a little bit less. I've actually sort of made an oath that I'm not going to move out of Ann Arbor because I don't necessarily feel safe in too many other towns. I mean, I don't necessarily think that every town along the way I'm going to have to worry about my life, but there are towns where I could either be beat up or killed just because I didn't pop out the womb and say, look, I am boy.
Eliza, what do you want the people who are listening to us talk right now, what do you want them to really and most clearly understand about who you really are and what it's meant for you to be able to present yourself to the world as the way you know you are?
Well, for me, it's just I wouldn't be me. You would be sitting in front of you'd be speaking to a puppet. Well, you wouldn't even be speaking to me. Like, I just probably wouldn't even have talked to anybody. I just would have been sitting in a corner being sad.
You're not sitting in a corner anymore.
No. I'm out in the middle of the room now.
Eliza Downey, junior at Michigan High School, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. It was really, really great to talk with you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Just a reminder, throughout this hour, we're taking your questions on Twitter at State of Op and on Michigan Radio's Facebook page. We have reporters and producers standing by there for you. And we also thought, let's go directly to the folks who get the most questions, young trans people. And we asked, what are the FAQs you get all the time?
I usually get questions about, so how do you plan on having sex?
How do you have sex?
I know more recently someone asked me how I masturbate. And I was like,
Yeah, usually I get asked uncomfortable questions about my, surgeries, quote unquote, what I plan to do.
Did they get the surgery? And I'm just like...
So, what's your biological sex?
So, what are you really?
That was Devin Ferries, Evan Murphy, Donover Cricket, Riley O'Brien, and Eliza Downey. You're listening to a State of Opportunity special, Breaking Ground, Being Young and Transgender in Michigan. This is Breaking Ground, Being Young and Transgender in Michigan, a State of Opportunity special from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Politicians and voters all across the country are weighing in on how young trans people should be treated in schools, in public restrooms, in locker rooms. But who's speaking for the gender nonconforming child? Clinical psychologist Dr. Tony Corretto saw the price paid by trans adults and their families and friends, a toll taken by years of being misunderstood and marginalized. So she shifted her focus more toward working with gender nonconforming children and their families. Dr. Tony Corretto, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You have something on your website that just knocked me flat, that data suggests that 6.9% of all teens have attempted suicide, but nearly one-third, 33.2% of transgender youth have done so. So that's what you're seeing, and that's what you're trying to start at an early age to intervene. And how do you do that?
Well, the kids are doing it a lot themselves. Thanks to the internet, you know, there's often a myth that kids are becoming transgender because of something they read on Tumblr or they found it on YouTube. And I have to point out, they put something into the search engine. So they typed in, even if they were 7 years old, they typed in girl that feels like a boy to get to that site. It's not that they're being persuaded. They're looking for it. And they're finding resources for themselves and finding the words and then going to their parents and coming out. And parents are responding appropriately most of the time.
Yes, because let's get into what you've seen in the lives of trans adults who couldn't be who they truly were when they were in those crucial childhood and adolescent years. And when you said parents mostly accepting, I have to imagine that's the first terrible blow, is if mom and or dad can't deal.
Maybe the second terrible blow. The first terrible blow, I think, is realizing that you're different than everyone else in your family. And then, yes, the second terrible blow being if there's family rejection. That's a setup for horrible outcomes. Caitlin Ryan at the Family Acceptance Project in California has done lots of studies on that as it pertains to LGBT youth and just the increase in rates of depression and suicide and drug abuse and other risky behaviors. School failure is just horrifying when you look at kids that don't have that family acceptance.
And even if you have acceptance within the home, there's the world at large.
Right.
What have you seen in the adults? What kind of toll is taken by the time someone has gutted through these years and they're an adult and you've worked with these folks?
Right. Well, they oftentimes make many attempts to not have it be true. So they often pursue efforts to cure themselves via marriages and career choices and drinking and behaviors and attempts to fit into the role that they don't feel suited for. And it leaves behind them a wake of damage both to their own personal lives and often the lives of many around them.
You made a statement to us that I think cuts right to the heart of just who these trans kids are. And you said that it takes so much bravery. This is not a whim. Talk to us a little more about that, Tony.
Yeah. Oftentimes, by the time a kid, a young person, verbalizes this to their family, they've thought about this for months, if not years. I think everyone's personal experience with coming out, whether it be as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, is the reaction that their families often have as the first response also, which is denial. Oh, no, this can't be true. I don't want it to be true. And looking for the evidence that it's not. So by the time they come to conclude that this is what's going on with them, this is not a whim. When families come to me, the parents are often in shock and it's news to them. And I often have to help them then negotiate or navigate, rather, the fact that the parents are several steps behind the young person. The young person's already dealt with denial and anger and feeling guilty, and parents are just now starting to come to terms with it. And they're at the stage of looking for the evidence to the contrary. And the kid's already been there and done that.
And it wasn't there. So the kid is further down the road, and you have to try to help mom, dad, and siblings move up the road and join with the child.
And to help the child slow down and have some empathy for your parents are going through what you yourself went. You may not remember it, or you may want to forget it, but
it goes two ways.
Exactly.
Let's say within my family, we have come to understand and support and celebrate a child who is transgender. So how can I, as a mom, give my child, whom I love with all my heart and soul, the armor to protect himself or herself from a world that may not treat them kindly or at worst try to harm them?
Well, depending on the child's age and developmental level, it varies. But I think basically if you can help them anticipate what they may encounter and how and kind of role play with them, if you will, how they would deal with it. This is what I do with a lot of the kids I work in my office, is to try to help them imagine what people might say or ask or do and how they would respond. And it needs to be a response that feels right to them. It needs to be in their own words. But I think helping them be aware of what might be out there and be prepared for it with empathy and with understanding that, you know, not everyone gets it like we do, or, you know, people don't understand, and just arming them with the right words.
What do you love most about the work you do with these families?
Seeing people really step back and reevaluate what's important in life, kind of having those philosophical moments, questioning, you know, what is gender anyway? Those kinds of discussions, and seeing people come to their own conclusions that are then meaningful to them, is what I love about the work. And to be able to see a young person do that is incredible. Oftentimes these kids, these individuals are wise beyond their years. And seeing parents and families be able to do it really, I think, speaks to, you know, what the meaning of love is, that someone's willing to take that journey, ask those hard questions, reevaluate themselves, and do the right thing. That's love.
Dr. Toni Corretto, thank you so much for talking with us today on State of Opportunity.
Thank you.
Now let's meet a family working through exactly what it means to have a child say, God made a mistake. 7-year-old Kai Torque is a happy kid. He loves playing baseball with his friends and building things with wood, metal, and duct tape. Kai was born biologically female, but as his father Pete says, Kai is a boy in every other way. Michigan Radio's Kyle Norris spent time with the Torque family at a Little League game.
This is classic Americana. You've got beautiful weather and families lined up along the fence cheering for their little baseball player. Parents like Pete Torque.
We are at the opening day of Dexter Little League watching the Mud Hens versus the Iron Pigs. It's an epic classic.
7-year-old Kai Torque's baseball cap is a few sizes too big, and he's eating one of those candy ring pops before the game.
We have a baseball game. I'm playing first base. I like hitting and I like catching the ball.
Kai describes himself this way.
A funny kid, athletic kid, smart.
Kai was born Jacqueline, which they shortened to Jack. But Jack has chosen the middle name Kai for himself. So you'll hear his family sometimes call him Jack Kai, because this name change is recent, and they're still figuring it out. Back at the game, Kai is up to bat. His mom, Sarah, and sister, Sydney, cheer him on.
And he swings it. But he's out. Good hit, though. Good hit, Jack.
Kai's father, Pete, wishes people could spend a day with him and learn how normal their life is with a transgender child, like hanging out at your kid's baseball game on a Saturday afternoon.
And that's the thing that's striking, is that it's not striking. You know, it's just ordinary, you know, at times boring, right? At times painful, you know, we go through all the same things that everybody else does.
He says if you hung out with them, you'd see it's no different than hanging out with your family and friends.
All right.
For State of Opportunity, I'm Kyle Norris. Kai's father, Pete Tork, is here with us now. Thanks for joining us, Pete.
Thank you.
How old was Kai when he started saying to you, wait a minute, I am not a girl, I'm a boy?
Yeah, it started at around age 2 when he first started saying, I'm a boy. You know, at the time, we weren't completely surprised because he had already played with toys that were, you know, considered, you know, we say boy toys, even though we know that girls can play with those boys too, right? But, you know, he played with superheroes instead of dolls. You know, he would choose a pirate ship over a dollhouse, those kind of things, right? So, of course, we just thought, all right, he's, you know, he's going to be a tomboy. And so it really didn't concern us much at all at that time. It was only when it started to become consistent and daily, and then it wasn't just, you know, him saying, I'm a boy. It was refusing to put on, you know, girl clothes, right, and dresses and things of that nature, and then it progressed from there.
At what point did you realize this is not a phase?
Well, the first indication of that was at age 2.5. And this was, you know, one of those epic battles of trying to get a dress, you know, on a kid, which is not unusual.
No, especially at age right? 2. Been you there, know, done that. Yeah.
That's right. It was one of those times where my wife had commented that you just wore this dress for pictures a couple of months ago. And he's like, no, that wasn't me. So she even got the picture, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, look, here you are. Mm-hmm. You look happy, right, in that dress. You know, he said, that wasn't me. So, and it wasn't just that, you know, I don't want to wear the dress. It was beyond that. And so that's what caused us to start looking online, you know, as to, you know, wow, what else could be going on here?
But things deepened and you started seeing real behavioral changes in acting out, didn't you?
And that's what finally causes you to take action and go to see the doctor and, you know, and
what
and
kinds
go
of
to see
things
therapist.
Were going on?
So from that point on, as Kai really started to express himself more, you know, he started saying that I don't like my hair. You know, it's long and it looks like a girl's.
That name Jacqueline, not welcomed, right?
That's right. Yeah. And the name was, you know, of course, a very big deal. And a lot of this progressed over the course of a couple years. But from that, kind of from that moment on about the, you know, kind of the dress incident, mm-hmm.
yeah.
right, it was consistent. And I would say if not daily, it was, you know, almost daily where there would be something that, you know, he would point out where it's like, you know, this is – things aren't matching up. You know, it included, you know, identification of his body parts because, you know, they – in daycare, you know, they still often will, you know, separate the kids by boy and girl and, you know, even things like, well, let's do this song and all the boys stand up, you know, and he would stand up with the boys, right? And so they noticed that too. So it was the consistency, the forcefulness, and the fact that it, you know, wasn't just, you know, the outward appearance, you know, he was not happy with his body.
And at what point then did you decide, right, you're Kai, we're going to start using the pronoun he, which I can only imagine was such a relief for this child.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that was one of the last things. And we always say that, you know, we're actually not proud of the fact that it took us even that long because it was a couple years of pain and despair, I would say. And so it progressed from clothes to the hair to the, you know, kind of pronouns. With the name Jacqueline, you know, we kind of pressed the easy button at first. It's like, oh, all right, we'll call you Jackie, right? But we weren't consistent. And certainly at the daycare and at preschool, they weren't consistent. So during that 2 years, you know, he started showing signs of other things like you'd associate with obsessive compulsive behavior. For example, I couldn't get him out the door in the morning to go to daycare and preschool you know, it was always something, right? Sometimes it would be sensory type things, you know, my clothes don't feel right, right? Those kind of things. And we finally, you know, we did change the haircut, and that was only after, you know, essentially one morning after another battle to get him out the door, and we're in the parking lot of the daycare. You know, let him out of his car seat, climbs up in the middle console, looks in the rearview mirror, mm-hmm. and starts crying and says, I look like a girl. I am not going. I my hair looks like a girl's. So that progressed until the point where it got so bad that in kind of a last-ditch effort, you know, and after talking to people, of course, we're aware that this could mean transgender, right? But the last thing was, you know, the consistency of the name and the pronoun usage. And I'll never forget the morning when I finally said, look, is this about the fact that they still refer to you as a girl, you know, as Jacqueline.
Mm-hmm. She.
In school, as mm-hmm. she, right? And not everybody knows that you're a boy. And it was like, yep, that's what it is. So I said, so you want me to go today and talk to them and let them know that you're a boy and, you know, we'll call you, you know, Jackie or Jack. And he said yes. And at that point, it was like a light switch.
In pain anymore.
No.
Not hurting. Your kid wasn't hurting anymore.
Absolutely. You know, so you could look at it as, right, there's a lot of other evidence building. But the litmus test is he happy? You know, I mean, and who doesn't want their kid to be happy, right? So that's the bottom line. I mean, and I witnessed this. I lived through it. I saw it. And from that point on, we had a happy kid.
And you do today.
We do today.
Yeah.
You know, and if it weren't for the fact that obviously not every kid, you know, does have support either at home or at school, and there's so much information. If it weren't for that fact that we know we need to get this message out and explain it to help everybody else, you know, we'd be on autopilot. For us, it didn't
coming right along at home.
Right. I mean, yeah. So Craig McCullough, right, our principal mm-hmm. at Cornerstone Elementary in Dexter, and top to bottom in the school district, right, we've had support. And there's been zero incidents, you know. I mean, it's just normal kid stuff, right? So, yes, you know, we would be on autopilot, except for we knew we had to get the message out. And, of course, the battle is kind of being brought to our doorstep, you know, with bathroom bills. Mm-hmm. So that's why we cannot remain silent.
You have been on a journey with Kai that has changed your life.
Well, I guess you could tell. and it has, you know, and I think, you know, our entire family. But, you know, certainly for me, you know, this has been an awakening.
Pete Torque's little boy, Kai, was the one we heard earlier as we began this segment. And I really want to thank you for sharing what you went through and really getting out there and sharing Kai's story and your family's story.
Well, thank you. You know, and I think if there's one thing we want to, you know, people to take away from this is that, and from this is for all the marginalized people out there, all the kids out there who feel lost and alone, that you are not alone. You know, there are many people out there that are with you.
Pete Torque, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
It's a complex and emotional issue for all of us, from these young trans people to their families and friends, to school administrators and teachers trying to meet the needs of their trans students, to Michiganders who continue struggling with the bathroom question. Clearly, there's lots to talk about and to understand, so much so we couldn't fit all of our questions into an hour. To hear extended versions of our interviews with Dr. Tony Coretto, Eliza Downey, and Pete Torque, just go to the State of Opportunity page at michiganradio.org. Breaking Ground, Being Young and Transgender in Michigan. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. The special was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Contributors are Cass Adair, Allie Billings, Tony Brown, Sean McHenry, Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, April Van Buren, and Jody Westrick. This State of Opportunity special is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for State of Opportunity comes from W.K. Kellogg Foundation, a partner with communities where children come first.